Thanks, Jamie. And now, for our second speaker, I'm very grateful that I've been able to watch this guy learn how we stay, how we stick around, but now he's going to talk to us about why we stay. That's Kurt Arp.
My name's Kurt. I'm an addict. Why we stay? When they first gave me the topic, I was like, why we stay? The first thing that popped in my mind, I don't know if you ever saw that movie, Officer and the Gentleman. And he's getting hosed down. He's got to do all these calisthenics. And the guy wants him to drop. And he goes, I got nowhere else to go. But in reality, I have choices. And I like the choices that it tells me about and who is an addict. It tells me if I don't stay here, I can go to jail. I can go to institution. I can live a life of dereliction or I can die. So that's a big reason why I stay. And the other thing was, I thought of a couple things. I had 3 weeks clean, I came home, and my mom said, I don't know what you're doing at them classes, but you need to keep going. She called meetings classes. And already the change had become kind of apparent to her that something was going on in my life, and it was a positive change. And then, of course, I always like the old George Carlin comment, just because a monkey's off my back doesn't mean the circus has left town. All right, so I need to stay for that reason alone. But anyway, on Wednesday nights in Central Maryland, we have a little meeting. We were reading out of the basic text every week, but then we came out with the Living Clean. We started reading a subchapter a week. We don't have a speaker, we just open it up, and it's a good little meeting, and I really love this book. And actually Wednesday, although I wasn't there, I was here getting ready to help with the convention, the subchapter was Why We Stay. But I didn't, I know there's why I stay and there's why we stay, right? It's why I stay clean is the most important thing for me. And what we do is we carry the message to the addict that still suffers, right? But for me, my primary purpose is to stay clean. So I was reading a couple things. You know, we go through this book. This is a second go-around. And it talked about, it says, recovery is a full contact, lifelong process. The more serious we are about it, the more clearly we can see how much growth is still available to us. No matter where we are in the journey, we are never done learning. Continued practice of the program of Narcotics Anonymous doesn't just make our lives easier, it makes them richer, better, and more interesting. And that's in the preface. And then it says right above that, and this is kind of what I'm going to talk about, kind of like why I stay, and then try to talk a little bit about maybe why we stay. But it says, just as the rewards of our recovery are often beyond our wildest dreams, we know that the impact of our recovery on our own lives and those around us is beyond measure. And when I first, my family life was like Leave It to Beaver. You know, I had two loving parents. I grew up in a stable family. I went to Catholic school down in, if any of y'all familiar with like D.C., down in a place called Chillum. Went there for 8 years, and then I went to a Catholic high school in Hyattsville to play sports. And not basketball, because I only got like a 2-inch vertical, right? something happened between the time I left the one school to go to the other one. I was always attracted to the guys on the corner. And back then, now I know some of you old heads remember the white hot top Chuck Taylors, full length leathers, Peter's jackets. Don't wear no London Fog, right? Peter jackets and fan lines, silk shirts, stuff like that. And they were standing on the corner, man, and for some reason I was attracted to that, you know, to listen to Motown, and, you know, we had our tiny little record players with the little 45s and the, like, 8 big D batteries, and, you know, the low man on the pole had to carry all the 45s, and that, and a 45, it's not a gun, it's old little records for all you young people, right? And now I can fit, like, what, 10,000 songs on a little thing the size of a pack of gum, right? So, and they were all listening to Motown, and we're just, you know, chilling and getting drunk and fighting, and I wanted to get with that, right? And so, if I wanted to get with them, I had to do what they did, and so I started using, you know, I put one in me, and, you know, sitting on the corner, got my full length leather and all this, you know, and I was terminally cool, fatally hip, and, you know, listening to Motown, I became like Runaway Child, Running Wild, and, just a ball of confusion. We could go on and on with this, right? Psychedelic shagging, right? But at the end, man, I was just too proud to beg, right? I was just, I was Papa was a Rolling Stone on it. Anyway, so, and what happened was, you know, going to school just wasn't that important anymore, and doing good in school. I had scored the top 5% of my entrance exam. I was in advanced placement classes. I was the only student they kept at that school that went from advanced placement to academic probation in one semester. Yeah, that's what they were saying. That's what my parents were saying. Like, who's this guy? And playing ball, and that's all I ever wanted to do, you know, just play ball, play football. And that's just wasn't important anymore. And the getting used and finding ways and means to get more became the most important thing in my life, and I didn't even realize it. And I would like to say that that's just as bad as it got, but it got a lot worse. And it also says that who is an addict, we get this like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde thing going. And eventually, Dr. Jekyll's gone and just Mr. Hyde just takes over. And I became a person I'm sure my parents didn't recognize, I didn't recognize. You know, I went from the hanging out with the full, you know, with the, we called them greasers, to, you know, then it was like 60s, late 60s, early 70s, everybody's a hippie, you know, smoke some weed, grow your hair, you know, turn on, tune in, drop out, Dr. Timothy Leary and the guys, and then because of some of the drugs I was doing, like some motorcycle people became involved, so I kind of morphed into that, and the whole time it just kept getting worse. And it talks about our literature, you know, it's a downhill slide. So, for some reason, you know, my parents should kick me out of the house the day I turned 18. Really, they should have tried to have me removed before then. But some things happened. You know, I had a dog, right, a Doberman, pretty dog. And I got to the point where I was just so spiritually bankrupt that I beat my own dog, right? How effed up is that, right? And my dog's name was Buddy, right? How you do that, right? And I remember doing it one day. My father looked at me, and I was his only son. He says, "I hope to God you never have any children." Like, he wanted my genes out of the gene pool. I'm his only son, right? And I remember the look in his eyes, and that's just, you know, I didn't care. That was just the person I'd become, you know, somebody that, you know, looking back, I don't recognize, you know. I was, I was selling PCP out of my parents' house for a long time, and you know what kind of clientele that brings, right? You know, I'm bringing these idiots into my house, my parents' house, you know, and I remember my mother told me one time, and you know, I was mama's boy, right? But she got tired of my stuff too, right? And she said, "You know what, you're the most hateful person I'd ever met." And still didn't, you know, it still got worse, you know. Like I said, I don't know why they didn't have, I guess they were trying to love me to death, they were enabling me, they didn't know what they were doing, but they were helping to kill me, and you know, they didn't know what else to do, I guess. You know, addict children don't come with directions. Well, so us addict children, right? And, And then, like I said, it got worse. I hurt my sister. I slammed her up against the wall and fractured her 6th and 7th vertebrae. I don't know any of y'all that are that up on the vertebral column, but the doctor said if Max had more of a fracture, she would have been paralyzed for life. C6, C7, that's a bad break, you know, and usually don't have anything below here, right? And she was in a custom-made steel neck brace for 3 months. She had to sleep in it. Came all the way down to here, held her. I guess it was before they had halos, maybe, I don't know. And so that's where it had gotten, you know. It was just ugly, man. It was just, and I don't think that I was capable of love. I definitely, and Jamie talked about it, man, I hated myself. I'd get all high up on some PCP and just start screaming myself in the mirror. My parents would probably think, you know, there's nobody else up there but him. Who the hell's he yelling at, right? But I would just, man, I just hated myself. And so I got to the end of the road, man, and I was hopeless and helpless. I couldn't stop. Not long before this, I had been in the hospital with hepatitis B. I'd had it for the second time. And I was jaundiced. I was sick. I was in the isolation ward. So when they come in to see me, right, they had everything on. They had the mask. They had the clear mask, gloves, booties, hats, you know. And I told the doctor, I was there 5 or 6 days, and I said, you think you could sign me out? And he's like, what? He goes, do you understand how sick you are? I said, I got this, right? I'm like, I'm a funky looking yellow man, and just sick. And I said, and he goes, I said, I've had this before, and I know, go home, take my vitamins, eat some fruit, I'll be good, lay on the couch. He goes, well, I'm going to sign you out against medical advice. He goes, I'll sign you out at AMA. He said, but I'm going to tell you something before you leave. And I said, well, what's that? He says, if you get this again anytime soon, you won't need the hospital. I said, really? He goes, no, you just need the morgue. He said, because it'll kill you. And I sat every second. I said, okay, but can you sign the papers now? And I left, and I used, because that's what we do, right? And I was powerless. And even though as much as I may have wanted not to use, I didn't have a choice. So not long after that, I was, somebody had called me in 1984. It's about 83. And I hadn't seen him for a while. And they said, I said, where you been? They said, I'm going to be going to some meetings. Now, I had been court ordered to AA in 1974 for hitting a cop in a Prince George's County police station. I don't know if any of y'all are familiar with Prince George's County Police, right? But that was a bad move, right? That was a real, they wore my ass out. And I woke up in the psych ward. Imagine that, right? handcuffed to the bed, head split open. They knew to hit me in the back of the head, right? Cracked my ribs, messed me up pretty good. And so I had been court ordered to 2 years of AA. But I was 18, I wasn't at that point, I wasn't trying to get it. I didn't, they didn't understand, they just leave me alone, blah blah blah, whatever. So I kinda had the concept, right? She said that she was going to NA, and she goes, some people here that you know, right? She told me some names. I said, wow, I thought they was dead, right? And I was like, well, that's good for you, right? But I ain't trying to do that. Well, at the end of the road, right? Well, I wasn't at the end of the road, but I could see it from where I was at. I called her up. I said, I'll go to a meeting. I go to a meeting. It was the old Hand of Hope meeting in Bladensburg. I go down there, and I said, there's 7 people there. I used with 4 of them. 3 of them had over a year clean. This is 1984. And I was like, wow, y'all got this, right? I mean, they were happy. They weren't. These guys were the guys used to sleep in the woods next to PG Hospital, so they could be first in line for their methadone in the morning, right? I didn't understand that, but I was like, they're not going to run out, man, right? But They were homeless, right? They was, you know, fire bell junkies, right? Now, there was a guy who said, man, if I get as bad as them, I might try to make a move, right? But I didn't stay there. Taught 90 meetings in 90 days. I was like, man, I got things to do, right? And yeah, I had things to do, like get more miserable, right? And more try to kill myself. But what I didn't realize at the time is those guys became a vision of hope for me before I could hear a message of hope. But I left for a year, I came back, and in that year, that's when I called that happen all. So I called this girl back, and I said, I want to go to a meeting. And she went to pick me up. I said, I'll go Friday. It was Monday. I'm leaving work. I had a reservation. I threw everything out, and I kept one set of words. I'm not a diabetic, right? So I don't know why I need an insulin syringe, right? And the guy was leaving work, and this guy had never done this before. He goes, hey, man, you're off all weekend, right? And I was kind of had some hope, right? I was going, man, I'm going to this meeting, man. Maybe some things will change. I said, yeah. And he goes, here's something for the weekend. And I looked down, and 20 minutes later, it was in me. And I was on another three-day run. And I finally called her, and I said, look. I said, I'll go. And she goes, I'll come get you right now. I said, no. I'll go Wednesday. So, but I did. I went. I finally went. And what happens, I went to that meeting, it was September 21st, 1985, in a beginner's meeting at St. Andrew's Church in College Park, a meeting that's no longer there, unfortunately, and I picked up a white key tag, and I haven't used since. And since then, my life has just, you know, I'm going to try to get into some of the things that have happened, and one of them was repairing the damage I had done when I was using. What happened because of, like I said, 3 weeks in, my mother said, I don't know what you're doing in them classes, but you need to keep going, right? So I did. I got to some steps that allowed me to make amends. And, you know, when my sister got married, my father had passed, she asked me to walk her down the aisle because I had made amends to her. And I just didn't say, look, I'm sorry. But I had to change the way I acted towards her. You know, my sponsor said, this isn't about, thank God for my first sponsor. He said, this isn't about just saying you're sorry and continue to act like an asshole. He says, you need to make amends and live that amends every day, right? And she asked me to walk her down the aisle when she got married. And we're friends today. I see her. I talk to her. We don't see each other often, but we're in contact quite a bit. She tells me she loves me. You know, I don't know how, but she does. We have a good relationship. But you got to watch it sometimes. She told me the last time we were together, she goes, you weren't really that bad. I said, think about that for a second. I said, do I have to remind you about a steel neck brace? She goes, yeah, you're right. You were that bad, right? My mother had a massive stroke. They said she wouldn't live tonight. She lived for 4 years, but she was paralyzed. She had no short-term memory. Like I said, she was total hemiplegia. And I became her legal guardian. I became her executive paid. She worked government for a long time. So all her money went into an account with my name on it. And I had to pay for her where she was at because I couldn't take care of her. She needed 24-hour care. And I didn't spend that money on anything except for what it was supposed to be spent for, because that's what I learned here, right? You do the right thing. And I became her legal guardian, I guess, not long after she had the stroke. And when you have somebody as your guardian or being appointed your guardian, they have to be represented by a lawyer, so you're not trying to pull okey-doke and get all their stuff. And she asked her lawyer, the lawyer that was appointed to her, said, what do you think about your son? And she said, he's my best friend. Imagine that, right? So, if I bite my finger, that stuff in my eye goes away. But, so that's what, and you know, and when my father said he hoped that God never had children, he was absolutely right. Absolutely 100%. At that point in my life, I mean, just, you know, when if I went somewhere and there were even kids there, I said, you need to get these kids out of here, right? Because just, I didn't even date women that had kids. Maybe for a day or two, right? But when I got clean, me and my former wife were supposed to adopt a baby, and it fell through. Well, 3 years later, they call us and they say, "Will you still take her? She's 3 years old. She weighed 20 pounds. She had some problems. You could count her ribs. Hair was falling out. You know, and she had a lot of problems. And from coming to Narcotics Anonymous, I knew there was people I could talk to steer me in a direction that I needed to go. And she needed like a lot of therapy. And we did that. And she was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder at 6 from the stuff that had happened to her. And she was diagnosed depressed and just all kinds of stuff, man. And we just put one foot in front of the other, and she's okay, you know. Hopefully my father would look at me differently today. You know, and that's one of the reasons I stay, right? Because I don't want to go back, because I will fast. I told my wife, if I ever use, your best bet is put an ex parte on me, change the locks, or move. I said, because everything around me just turns to shit, right? And I don't want to be that person. I don't want to be that guy today, right? That's why I stay. That's why I continue to stay. And it talks about our life gets richer. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about why I hope we stay. I didn't take this. In the last chapter, last subchapter in Living Clean is love. It says, we are practicing step 12 to the best of our ability. Love becomes central to all that we do. There is no more powerful antidote to the despair and self-destruction of addiction. And so, you know, like I was talking about, when I got here, there were guys here that became a vision of hope for me. You know, they were like, you know, they were just a vision of hope, because I knew in my heart of hearts that if they could get clean and stay clean and be happy, that I could too. Because like I said, they were, you know, fire barrel junkies, you know, and they were responsible, productive members of society, and they showed up, you know, and they did service work, and they had sponsors, and they worked steps, and a lot of them were like, really helped me in the beginning, especially, you know, I struggled with the God thing, and my buddy goes, you ain't him, don't worry about it. I was like, damn, that's like one of the most profound things I ever heard, right? I mean, that's simple, right? They kept it simple back then, right? But I remember I got clean and I got a sponsor, and I said, when are we going to start writing these steps? And he says, man, I'm not into that. I got a sponsor that was into that, you know, because I wanted this thing, man. I wanted to change. I wanted, you know, I had so much, that first meeting, I just finally had some hope that maybe this would just work for me. And it was because of those guys were here to tell me, that they came here before me to carry the message that Narcotics Anonymous, an addict, any addict can stop using. Anybody can stop using. And just as importantly for me, lose the desire to use. Because, man, I had that, you know, the desire for me is the mental obsession to use those things that are killing me, followed by a physical compulsion which forces me to continue. That's a no-win situation. That's like playing Russian roulette with an automatic and one-up. You know what I mean? It's just, you know. So I could be relieved of that here. And I could find a new way to live. And that's the message that was carried to me when I first got here. And for me, that was life-saving. Nothing short of life-saving. And life, I don't know how to say it, just it kind of like gave me the ability to see that I could transform my life into something more than what it had become. And so what's important for me is that I continue to carry the message, that I come back and tell the newcomer that I stay. You know, I wanted to leave a meeting the other day, and I probably count on both hands the time I've been here when I left the meeting early. I'll tough it out, right? And I remember I was getting ready to leave, and this guy raised his hand, he shared, he said, I'm new and I need help. And I knew I couldn't leave because I had to stay and get that guy my phone number, right? Because that's what we're supposed to do. And sometimes, you know, like the other, well, it wasn't too long ago, I saw a woman and nobody was talking to her. She was new. And I went up to some women and said, you need to go talk to her. And they got a little mad, right? But oh well, right? She was standing there all by herself and nobody was talking to her. And from coming around here, I've been able to become a sponsor. And I guess there's no greater joy than to see, you know, my sponsees coming here. And I don't sponsor women. Right? That's just me. Y'all do what you want, right? I don't sponsor women. But my guys, right, I see them come in, right, and a lot of times they're fresh out of rehab, right, and they're walking around looking at their shoes, right, and, you know, they don't feel part of, right, and, you know, they don't know the language. I didn't know the language when I got here. I said, what are they talking about? What that mean? What's self-centeredness mean? What's that mean? That means, Scott. Anyway, so, you know, and after a couple, you know, you know, I said, look, you know, maybe you need to get a serving position. You need to become a part of. You need to give back. You know, so freely given to you. And you see them, they get served. My first sponsor said, he said, we're going to a meeting at this person's house. I said, they're having an NA meeting at somebody's house? He said, it's a public information meeting, and you're the newest member. He didn't ask me, right? He said, be there. And guess what? I became the newest member, public information. And then I became... back then, they didn't have a hotline, that helpline. I became the chair of the helpline. I became the chair of public information. I became the literature chair. I became the chair of the area. I was able to do these things and stay in here. And I think if you're doing a lot of service work, you won't leave here, right? So anyway, I get to see these guys that I sponsor. And just not just my guys I sponsor, but anybody come in here, right? And they, you see the change start, right? You see them start, you know, you tell them, you know, they got all this wreckage. You tell them that if you put one foot in front of the other one, this too shall pass, right? You'll get to the other side of that, you know, and you'll get a license back. One friend of mine, they told him, the state of Maryland said, you will never have a license in the state of Maryland. Guess what? He's got a license in the state of Maryland. I took him to get it, right? Because I wanted to see that. He said, and I was studying for a big exam, but he was so, come on, man, can you take me? Can you take me? They're going to give me my license back. I said, yeah, I'll take you, right? So I studied in the van while I went in, the truck while I went in and got it. But, you know, that's what we do, right? But I can see, you see the transformation in people's lives, man. And they come around and they you know, they start shining, right? And they get in service and they start to, like, kind of like, I guess, get a life, right? You know, and some of them get married and they have kids and they have beautiful lives and they become responsible, productive members of society. And that just fills my heart up, right? But it's important for me to keep coming back. The reason I stay here, not only for myself, because, you know, I'm trying to stay clean too, right? And I'm trying for my life to get better, but to carry the message to these people that you can get clean too and your life can be better than you've ever imagined, just like they told me, you know? And I don't know how much time I got. I'm about done. But I got a call when I was... I think we were on our way down Wednesday night, and I got a call from one of the guys I used to sponsor, and he's on a chemo drip. Well, not right as we speak, but he's getting it quite a bit, and he's older. He can't do a bone marrow biopsy or transplant because they say he's too old. He's got leukemia, and he thanked me for helping him, right? And that's why I keep coming back, right? I got diagnosed with cancer 7 years ago, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. I didn't have to use. I can share that with people. You know, that was a fear on my fourth step before last. One of my fears was that I would get diagnosed with a potentially fatal disease. Besides the disease of addiction, besides the hepatitis C, right? And I didn't have to use over it. And fortunately, mine's not acute. It's not chronic. It's called indolent. It moves slow, but it'll be back. They keep telling me it'll be back. I'm in remission. But I can, you know, I stay around to share that with people, right? Because there was always somebody be able to tell me the day I got diagnosed, I got a call from the doctor, not supposed to tell you on the phone, they did, and I felt like somebody had kicked me in the stomach. I'm like, game over. at that time in Central Maryland, like 12 people got diagnosed. Me and my buddy Bob, that I told you to call me, the only two still alive. That night there was a girl named Miracle Mary celebrating, 3 years clean. I gave her that name because she had supposed to have been dead a long time before that. She had brain cancer. And she was celebrating 3 years clean. And I went to that meeting and I shared and realized, man, I'd have to use. You know, what's going to happen is going to happen. So I can share that with the newcomer that, man, you don't have to use today, you know. And I'll close with this. You know, I read this story one time. There was a guy, and he was like the wise man of his village. And look, I'm not trying to say I'm the wise man in any village, right? But but this guy was, and so one of the people who lived in the village, they said they walked up to him. He was plowing his field, right? And they asked him, they said, the villagers have a question for you. What would you do if they told you that today was your last day on earth? He thought for a minute, he goes, I hope I'd keep plowing my field. And I don't know that I'll ever have that level of acceptance, but if I keep coming back, maybe one day I will. And thanks for letting me share.